sounds like the track team is doing what they can to help.
It's an amazing group of kids. It really is.
Well, that's it for us, Keith says into the camera. We'll see you again next time. Thanks for watching Live at 5.
Mom turns off the recorder and says, that wasn't so bad, was it?
Kaylee snorts. Are you kidding? It was great.
She's back to texting, but she takes a second to look at me.
You're a celebrity.
Oh, right. I laugh. But seeing everything my team is doing for me, condensed into a 3-minute broadcast, has made me feel good. Really, really good. Chapter 11. The next morning, Fiona and I run into Annie and Giselda in the courtyard.
You guys were awesome, I tell them. So funny.
The word, Annie says with a haughty look, is lively.
Yes, Giselda says, looking down her nose at me. We are lively.
Indeed, I say with a laugh, and funny, too. Shandell joins us, and I say, Speedy Feet, you are on TV.
I look good, too, didn't I?
She says with a grin, and then hugs me.
Girl, I am so happy for you. You are going to have that running leg in no time.
Then Mario and Graham and Melanie and Colin and a bunch of other track people join us, and our little gathering turns into a full-on celebration. The whole day is like that. It's really upbeat, really fun. Even Ms. Rucker manages to say something nice. Well, for her, anyway.
I hope your parents found a good lawyer. The situation's ridiculous.
Then she gets back to business, arching one eyebrow as she zeroes in on me. Next to note you pass puts you back in your assigned seat. I grin at her.
Yes, ma'am.
There's an odd sort of twitch at the corner of her mouth before she turns and walks to the front of the classroom. Rosa has rolled up in the middle of this, and when Ms. Rucker is far enough away, she whispers,
Was that a smile? That may be as close as she gets,
I whisper back. Rosa pulls her binder out of a saddlebag.
Gavin came into our lunchroom today. He was looking for you.
What? He did?
I'm embarrassed by how excited I sound.
Uh-huh.
She gives me a lopsided smile.
He's really cute.
I tone things way down.
He has a girlfriend, Rosa, a really pretty one.
Meryl, I know.
She eyes me.
He could do a lot better.
The tardy bell rings, and Ms. Rucker wastes no time announcing that there'll be a test on Friday. I groan because I am not ready for a test, not even close. So I really try to focus on the lesson, but I'm having trouble keeping up with Ms. Rucker's overheads. Rosa slips me a note.
Come over tonight. I'll help you.
I nod and put the note away, and that night after dinner, that's exactly what I do.
Are you sure you don't want to ride?
My mother asks as I'm heading out the door. I'm sure. It's nearby, and Sherlock needs a walk.
They won't mind him being with you?
Rosa loves Sherlock. She's following me down the walkway. Tell me again who Rosa is, and how does she know Sherlock?
Mom, stop. It's fine. Everything's fine.
Her last name is Brazzi. She's a math genius, and she lives on Marigold Street. I'll call you from her house, okay? She lets me go, and as Sherlock and I play frisbee along the way, I'm really glad I didn't accept a ride. The air's cool but not cold, and with the days growing longer, there's still plenty of sunlight and lots of spring color everywhere. Rosa's mother is as happy about me arriving as mine was worried about me leaving.
Jessica, she says after Rosa has let me in, I feel like I know you from the paper and the news.
She eyes her daughter. And, of course, Rosa has told me all about you. She makes me bring Sherlock in off the porch. We can't have him miss the party. I laugh. Doing math does not exactly qualify as a party. But to the two of them, it seems to. There's a spread of snacks ready on the kitchen table, with bright blue paper plates and napkins. This should keep your math energies high, Rosa's mom says. I do remember to call my mom. And as I'm getting ready to hang up, Rosa's mom says she'd really like to say hello to her.
So I turn the phone over, and she takes it into another room to talk while Rosa helps me tackle math at their kitchen table. Over the next 2 hours, we submerge ourselves in finding the sums of infinite geometric series, calculating iterate functions, and expanding powers of binomials. We also manage to eat most of what's on the table. Finally, Sherlock seems to sense that I've had about all the math I can take for one night, because he nudges me from under the table, where he's been curled up, and lets out a little, "Aroo!" Rosa laughs. "I love the way he talks to you." Sherlock's head pops up between us, and after Rosa's had a chance to nuzzle with him, I collect my things and say, "All right, boy, let's get going." "If you come back tomorrow," Rosa says, "I'll give you a pretest."
"What do you mean?"
"Ms. Rucker is very predictable."
"She is."
"I'll make you a test," she says with a nod. "It'll be a lot like hers. You'll see."
If she's willing to do that, I'm willing to try. "Okay," I tell her. "Same time?"
"Same time," she says with a smile.
I thank Rosa and her mom for having me, then head home in the cool night air. The house is quiet when I get home. It's also dark, except for a little light coming from the kitchen. "Mom?" I call. "I'm home."
"In here,"
comes her voice from the family room. I find her sitting sideways on the couch, hugging a pillow. I click on a lamp. "Are you okay?"
"I'm fine," she says with a sigh.
Then she tilts her head and asks, "Why didn't you tell me that Rosa has cerebral palsy?" I sit down beside her and take a deep breath. "I was going to, but why didn't you?" I don't really know where to begin on this. It's been a feeling more than a rational thing, but it's true. I haven't wanted to mention it. I shake my head. "Rosa and I write notes in class." She waits.
"So?"
"So I didn't talk to her at all before I lost my leg. I ignored her. But now..." I lift my backpack and zip open the smallest pouch. "Sometimes she writes things." I pull out my growing collection of her notes. They're little scraps, half sheets, strips. It's a mess, really. It looks like a small pile of garbage.
"You keep them?" she asks.
I don't really know how to explain it. I sift through the notes. She has a way of... I look up at Mom. It's like she opens my eyes. Mom considers this for a moment. "Can you give me an example?" I'm sifting through the notes again. "Here," I say, pulling one out. "She asked me, if you could change one thing, what would it be?" I look up from the note. Not like a wish. It had to be something real.
"And what did you say?"
"That I could run again. But when I asked her the same thing, she said," I turn to the note, "that people would see me, not my condition." We're both quiet a minute. And then Mom asks,
"Do you feel bad because you didn't do that before?"
I almost say yes, but I stop. And in that moment, I understand why I keep Rosa's notes. "Not anymore," I say quietly. "I feel good because now I do." Chapter 12. After Rosa's done putting me through my paces the next night, I feel really confident.
"You will get an A tomorrow," she tells me.
I snort. That would be a first.
"But not a last," she's smiling. "You want to come in at lunch for a review?"
"I may just do that," I tell her, because I'm making the connection between training to break a league record and training to ace a math test. Repetition, effort, pain, success. There really is no shortcut. So the next day I go to room 402 at lunch and do my best to volley back right answers to Rosa's ad-lib math problems. She baits me to make mistakes by giving problems with my most common weaknesses, but I pull through okay. When the warning bell rings, she tells me,
"You will do great." but it isn't until math class is over that I believe her.
How was it?
She asks when the tests are all collected. I'm afraid to say easy.
Yes,
she says, and surprises me with a fist bump. We hang around and talk over some of the problems, and then Fiona pops her head inside the classroom. You ready? She asks. Oh, I forgot. I turn to Rosa. Fiona's taking me to Hankenstein's today. It should be my last fine-tuning for a while. Have fun, she says, and her face has suddenly gone mischievous. I turn around and discover that Gavin is now standing in the doorway behind Fiona. How would you feel about Gavin coming along? Fiona asks, her eyebrows going all wiggly. She's obviously trying to do me a favor.
It's okay to say no, Gavin says over Fiona's shoulder.
You can go,
Rosa tells him. I turn to her and whisper,
what?
Which makes her break out giggling. I don't know, I tell Gavin. But Fiona's giving me a secret fierce look, and I'm feeling a little heady and odd, and they're all staring at me, so I say, whatever, if you're sure you want to, fine. Then I turn to Rosa and whisper,
I'm going to sick Sherlock on you this weekend.
She giggles some more. See, Rosa, Fiona calls, and Gavin chimes in with, bye, Rosa, as we leave the classroom.
Bye, guys, she calls.
Her voice is happy, but it leaves a little ache in my heart. She is the one I'd like to take along. Chapter 13. Chloe is happy to see that I've got company, and when I make the introductions, she's excited to find out that Gavin is the one who wrote the newspaper article. It was awesome, she tells him, then goes on to say how she caught the story on TV. My friends and I are all rooting for you, she tells me with a big, warm smile. Thank you, I answer, but I feel a twinge of selfishness. She's so kind and attentive. It makes it easy to forget that she's had to go through an amputation and rehabilitation, too. Not to mention cancer. I change into shorts, and when I return to the waiting room, Chloe says, Hank's ready for you. Are you all coming in back, or just Jessica? Everyone looks at me.
Do you want to? I ask.
They say they do. And I guess I feel bad making them stay in the waiting room, so I shrug and say, okay. And it would have been okay, except that after Hank tells me how great the TV news story was, the first thing he does is check my socket fit. He makes me sit down and take off the suspension sleeve, and then he grabs the socket part of my leg and moves it around.
You're loose. We need to get you into thicker socks.
Off come the leg and the liner. Off come the socks and the nylon. Suddenly I'm feeling very self-conscious. Naked. Fiona looks down, and Gavin turns away and stays that way. I'm reminded of how awful it looks. It's not red and swollen. It just looks like flesh. But it's still very graphic, very gone. And all of a sudden, I'm mortified. Why in the world did I let them come back here? Fiona's fine, but Gavin? I'm desperate to get this over with, to cover up, to get out of here. Hank has me try on different thicknesses of socks until he's satisfied that my socket fits right. Then we start with the adjustments. I wish for music, conversation, sound of any kind. Finally, Gavin breaks the silence, but he looks at Hank, not at me.
I saw a man at an airport once who had art painted on his prosthetic leg. It was a sunrise in the ocean. It looked really cool.
Wow, Fiona says, and then asks Hank, can you do that?
I can do fabric,
he says, as I begin a test walk for him. Fabric? Fiona says, what do you mean?
Any piece of cloth. It only takes about half a yard. When I worked in San Francisco, people brought in skull fabric, dolphin fabric, tie-dye, camel fabric, you name it. Around here, our clients tend to be more conservative.
When I turn around, he catches my eye.
We could do that with your definitive leg if you want. It doesn't cost anything extra. I just embed the cloth when I'm making the socket.
Fiona's all excited. We should go to the fabric store and pick out something really cool. You could do flames or flowers or just a solid, like, hot pink. I'm holding still now as Hank's tweaking the adjustments of my top coupling. But I really just want a leg that looks like a leg. I don't want flames or flowers, and I sure don't want pink. Hank says,
Well, we can't order your permanent leg until your residual limb is completely stabilized, so you have a couple of months to decide if you want a cosmetic cover or an exposed artistic socket. Maybe consider it for your running leg?
Suddenly, flames seem like a really cool idea. I grin at Fiona. That I could get into. On our way out, Gavin holds doors open for me and makes sure I'm safely in the car before closing my door and getting in back. Well, I say as Fiona's driving out of the parking space. Thanks for taking me. I turn to Gavin. I hope it didn't freak you out too much.
Not at all,
he says. So where am I dropping you? Fiona asks, looking in her rearview mirror.
Home, if you don't mind,
Gavin replies. He's just a few blocks past me, I offer. I glance over the headrest. I used to run by your house to get down to the river.
I've seen you, he says. You got a cool dog.
Sherlock, I laugh. He laughs too.
And your cool dog has a cool name.
Fiona drives to my house, and it's strange. I'm laughing and joking with Gavin like we've been friends forever. And when we get to my house, I'm feeling flushed. Happy. I know he has a girlfriend, but he's being really nice to me. Why did he want to go to Hankenstein's? It couldn't just be scientific curiosity. He gets out of the back seat while I maneuver out of the front, and he holds the door open for me. Thanks, I tell him with a smile.
Sure, he says. Thanks for letting me tag along.
Then I watch from the sidewalk as he gets into the front passenger seat and drives away with my best friend. Chapter 14. It hits me like a ton of bricks. Gavin wants to spend time with Fiona, not me. Immediately, I start to make connections. Who did Gavin help with the Welcome Back Jessica sign in the Greek theater? Who's bound to have caught his eye while he was with Meryl at the high jump pit? Who did he cheer for up at Rigor Mortis Bend? Who's always there when he comes up to talk to me? Who is caring and involved and a doer just like him, my beautiful, long-legged best friend, Fiona? Over the weekend, my thoughts grow darker and darker. I feel like a total idiot. What was I thinking? How could I even have hoped that Gavin might actually like me? How could I have fantasized even for a minute that things could be normal? I also can't help but fixate on the fact that while I'm hobbling around at home, Fiona's at league finals running. I was supposed to be there. I was on track to win. I try to think of good things, but somehow negative thoughts creep in. They take root so easily, like pesky weeds in a delicate garden. What I need is a run, a good, hard run to clear my head, to make me feel whole again. Instead, I walk Sherlock to Rose's. She's just back from a CP yoga class, something she says is part of her physical therapy program. I tell her it sounds like a lot more fun than mine. It's nice to visit with her, nice to laugh a little, but I'm restless and moody, and after about a half an hour, I leave.
Cheer up, she calls as I make my way to the sidewalk. Your finish line is right around the corner.
Thanks, I call back. And I think about that as I walk home. Fiona calls late Sunday afternoon, and I make myself sound upbeat. Hey, how'd it go? Did you place?
No, she says. I had kind of an off day.
And we got second in lead. Langston squeezed us out. She sounds very low-toned, very un-Fiona.
Oh, I'm sorry, I tell her. There's a pause, and then... Listen, can I come over?
Sure.
I can tell something's wrong, but it isn't until after she's hung up that I realize what it must be. I'm right about Gavin. He's fallen for my best friend. In the 15 minutes it takes for her to arrive, I remind myself what an amazing friend she's been. I tell myself I'm happy for the two of them, and I promise myself that I will tell her he's perfect for her, and that I'm so glad my tragedy has brought them together. I reword that last bit in my mind, then cut it altogether. When the doorbell rings, I usher her in and hug her and congratulate her on an amazing season and tell her I'm sorry she's bummed. I don't know if I'm actually bummed, she says, following me inside. So what's wrong then? We settle in on the couch. She takes a deep breath, holds it, then lets it go. How would you feel if I went to the prom?
He asked her to the prom? Not just to the movies, to the prom? And when did he break up with Meryl?
My heart tries to sink, but I yank it back up. I can handle this. I'm ready for this. It's okay.
I'd be really happy for you, I say with enthusiasm.
Then, to savor the trauma of breaking it to me, I ask, did he ask you after he dropped me off on Friday?
Did he?
She gives me a confused look. What? Gavin, did he ask you to the prom after you dropped me off on Friday? She looks horrified.
Gavin?
Fiona, he obviously likes you. And I think you're perfect for each other.
Shut up!
I do.
He doesn't like me. And he has a girlfriend. What are you, crazy?
There's a lump forming in my throat. I feel so wrecked, so emotionally wrung out. She grabs my arm.
Mario's the one who asked me to the prom.
Mario? I ask, and my chin starts quivering. Mario, she says back.
But I thought...
I shake my head. Why else would he have come along? She scoots in and gives me a hug.
You are worthy, okay? Quit telling yourself you're not.
All of a sudden, I'm crying. Thanks, I whisper, and hug her tight. Chapter 15. Monday brings some good news. My first A on a test in Ms. Rucker's class.
93! Rosa squeals. Congratulations!
She has her usual 100%, but that doesn't bother me a bit. I earned a 93.
Thank you so, so much.
I think Rosa's as happy as I am about my grade. And I guess we're being a bit exuberant because Eric Hollander in one of the seats in front of us turns around and says,
"You got A's? Dude, I got a D."
I snort. I would have had an F if it wasn't for Rosa. I put my arm around her. She's an amazing tutor. He scratches his forehead.
I've been going to math lab twice a week, and this is what I get?
Forget math lab, I tell him. Go to room 402 at lunchtime. Rosa will whip your grade into shape.
He looks at her.
Really?
Any day,
she smiles.
I'm good.
I laugh because... I'm good. It's just not something you'd expect from Rosa, but it's so true. He frowns at his paper.
Maybe I'll take you up on that.
I can tell he's in the place I was a month ago. He's thinking that there's got to be some other way to get help, that he'll figure something else out, something that doesn't require dealing with a girl in a wheelchair. So after math is over, I hurry to talk to him outside the classroom.
Hey, I know she's hard to understand at first, I say, keeping my voice down, but that goes away. She's really nice. She's patient, and she's great at explaining math. I'd be flunking without her.
He nods.
Thanks.
I can tell he's still not convinced, so I call after him. You can always take the course again next year. He turns and pulls a horrified face. I laugh. Exactly. Then I call, room 402, lunchtime. As the week wears on, Gavin bumps in and out of my life. He's nice, friendly. I do see him with Merrill from time to time, but he also appears out of nowhere a lot. I try hard not to read anything into his presence, but it's an effort. I try to tell myself that I'm more than a legless girl, but that's an effort, too. Then, Thursday during lunch, I decide to stop by room 402, and to my surprise, Eric Hollander is inside, getting tutored. I wave a quick hello, and then slip out again, feeling very, I don't know, satisfied? Whatever it is, it feels good. During math, Rosa jots me a note.
He is so lost.
I jot back.
You will save him.
She smiles at me, and later I see her read the note again, and then slip it inside her pocket. I think about all the notes from her that I've kept, and I wonder if she knows that she's helped me with much more than math. It's nice to think I've helped her, too. She will save Eric, and when she does, he'll see her, not her condition. I wish more people could. Chapter 16. Friday morning, there's a message from Cairo in the announcements, commanding all track members to report to his room at lunch to return uniforms and finalize banquet plans. But when Fiona and I arrive, we discover there's a third item on the agenda. Running leg money. After checks started coming in from the newspaper article, Cairo drew a fundraiser thermometer on his whiteboard. Only it's not a thermometer. It's a prosthetic running leg with zero at the toe and a $20,000 at the top of the socket. He's been coloring in the leg with green marker, and any time anyone wonders how the fundraising's coming along, all they have to do is look at the board. Ever since the televised newscast, I've been trying not to check. But now, I can't help but see that the leg is completely colored in. Actually, it's overflowing. Cairo asks everyone to settle down, then announces,
"This weekend's car wash is hereby canceled, and those of you who are still baking can stop already."
He points to the whiteboard.
"Way to go, people! You did it!"
A loud cheer goes up, and then he continues.
"I spoke with our anonymous donor this morning, and she..."
"She?" I ask. I know it's hopeless because I've been nagging him about it since he announced that there was an anonymous donor, but I try one more time anyway. "I'd really like to thank her, Cairo. Can't you please tell us?" Cairo realizes he's slipped up, but he shrugs it off with a wave of his hands.
"I just eliminated half the population. That's the best I can do. Now, as I was saying, our anonymous donor is still going to send a full $10,000, even though we've collected nearly 15,000 on our own."
15,000? I look around the room.
"You guys are amazing."
Another cheer goes up, and after Cairo explains that any extra money can go to helping my parents with medical bills, he calls,
"Item 2!
And moves on to passing out banquet information and checking in uniforms. While this is going on, I notice Fiona and Mario fluttering awkwardly around each other. It's incredibly cute, and pretty obvious that he really likes her. And when people begin filing out of the classroom, Fiona's eyes ask me if it's okay if she leaves with Mario, so I smile and nod, like, go have fun. Soon, it's just Cairo and me.
"Quite a year," he says to me,
and we both laugh at the understatement. "How can I ever thank you?" I ask quietly. He smiles at me. It's a kind, tired smile.
"Just meet me on the track next year. That'll be thanks enough."
I nod, and even though there's no handshake, the deal is made. Which means there's no room for excuses. I'm going to have to learn to run again. Chapter 17. The rest of the school year sort of fizzles to an end for me. It feels like a waiting game. First, I wait for the prom to be over. During the weeks leading up to it, everyone seems to pair up. Then the only thing the girls want to talk about is their dresses and how they're going to do their hair and what their before and after plans are. Fiona goes to the prom with Mario. Gavin goes with Merrill. I stay home and watch TV. I try to be big about it, but can't help wondering if I'd have a date, too, if I wasn't walking around on a pipe. I try to block it out, but the thought keeps springing up. More weeds in my garden of worthiness. At the track banquet, the team presents me with a check for my running leg, which is an awesome and very emotional thing for me. But when I go to see Dr. Wells, he tells me that my stump is still changing and that I'm not ready for a definitive prosthesis. I have to wait until the end of June. Or maybe July. The school year closes out with finals and all too frequent encounters with Gavin. I managed to get a B or better in all my classes, even Ms. Rucker's, where I've climbed up to 82% thanks to Rosa. It's Gavin I can't seem to figure out. He's still with Merrill, but when I see them together, he looks quiet. When he runs into Fiona and me, he comes to life, laughing and smiling and talking about everything. But Fiona's still with Mario, and I've still got a pipe leg. I try not to define myself that way, but I can't help it. And even though my gait is now smoother and people swear they don't even notice, I never forget that under my pants is a pipe. So the school year fizzles to an end, and I wait. Fiona keeps me moving forward. She gets us preparing for the SAT books for over the summer, because I didn't take the test this year, and she wants to retake it in November. This way we'll both be totally prepared. Plus, it'll actually be fun to study because we'll be doing it together and we won't have any other homework. I know I'm supposed to take the tests, but it seems so pointless. You don't need SAT scores to get into the local JC, which is where it looks like I'll be going. Still, it'll be something to do with Fiona, which is better than doing nothing. Fiona also manages to get us job interviews at the Tremont Theater. It's an old-timey single-screen movie theater that shows foreign films and cult classics, a funky, cool place that's run by a bohemian grandma named Greta. I don't mention my leg when I go into interview, and Greta's got hobbles of her own and doesn't seem to notice that there's anything different about me. She just talks to me about popcorn and pigeons and hires me on the spot. Fiona and I don't actually start working there until school lets out for the summer, and it turns out to be a pretty fun job. After we're trained, Greta's nice about giving us the same shift, and we do everything from selling tickets and making and selling popcorn to sweeping up between shows and shooing away pigeons. Kids from school come in, especially the artsy ones. It's kind of nice, because even though it's a totally different crowd from the one I hang out with, they take their movies very seriously. And then, at the end of June, Dr. Wells decrees that my leg is stabilized and gives me a prescription for my permanent leg, which means I can also get my running leg. I go through the same routine all over again with Hank, casting, wait a week, socket fit, wait a week. But then I have to wait another week for the leg fit. And another week. Hank has decided that what I need is an active foot for my everyday leg. A flex foot that will even allow me to run.
It's not for track work, he tells me, but it's a very dynamic foot. You'll be amazed.
But there's a part on back order. A part on back order. Somehow I've almost blocked from my mind that I'm an assemblage of nuts and bolts and carbon graphite. July is almost over when I finally get called in for my fitting. And since, after weeks of proving to her that I can, Mom has finally allowed me to start driving again, she lets me go to Hank's alone. She usually likes to come to my appointments and hover, but she tells me she's swamped. Would you mind? She asks.
Not a bit, I tell her, and it's the truth. I love driving. It did take a little adjusting to learn to drive with my fake leg, because my ankle doesn't flex and I have to control the gas and brake pressure by using my knee and thigh.
But I'm good at it now. And it's nice not to have my mom in the passenger seat scared out of her mind that I'm about to crash. Plus, I know the appointment's going to be a long one. We've got two legs to fine-tune.
You've got your cell phone, right? She asks.
Right. It's another thing I've had to wait ages for, and now that it's replaced, I don't go anywhere without it. So I'm feeling footloose and fancy-free. But when I arrive at Hank's, I learn that the running leg is not done. A manufacturer delay, Chloe explains. Hank will call you in as soon as it's ready. I try not to show how disappointed I am. The thought of running again has kept me awake nights for weeks. My heart starts racing, and I just can't seem to settle it down. Some nights I sneak downstairs to watch the YouTube clips just to convince myself that it's not a dream, that I really am going to be able to run. And now I have to wait again. But the minute I walk on my new leg, I forget about the running leg, at least for a little while. My new leg is amazing. It goes on a little differently than my first leg, and it uses what's called a shuttle lock system. A suction sleeve liner goes right over my stump, and it has a 2-inch notched metal peg sticking out of the bottom of it. When I put my stump into the socket, the notched peg pushes down through a hole in the base of the socket. It makes a ratchety clicking sound as it goes in, and then I'm connected. The suction sleeve is locked into the socket, and the combination feels snug and comfortable, like it belongs. And the foot! Under the rubbery fake toes are layers of black carbon graphite that look nothing like a real foot, but the foot flexes with me and gives some bounce to my step. I love this, I say after the preliminary adjustments are done. I had no idea it would be this much better than my first one. It still looks very Frankensteinish, but more high-tech. Instead of a pipe, it's got a 2-inch-wide flat black carbon graphite bar.
I'm going to need for you to come back for fine-tuning like you did before, Hank tells me. And when we've got you dialed in, we'll get you a cosmetic cover.
He smiles at me.
You'll be standing pretty.
I stop walking and take a good look at him. I wonder how I could ever have hated this man, or at least how I could ever have been so angry with him. Thanks, I tell him softly. Thanks for helping me through this. He smiles at me.
I know it seems like a lifetime to you, but you've made outstanding progress in the short time you've been coming in.
This time, I feel like I deserve the compliment. I've worked hard on my gait, on learning how to adapt. And watching myself in the mirror now, I see that part of my problem was the tools I was using. The old leg was clunky compared to this one. With my new flex foot, my gait looks smooth, my stride confident. I feel almost normal. When we're done and his tools are put away, he walks me out.
The one thing I can't build from a client's is up here, he says,
tapping his head with a finger.
No matter how good the prosthesis is, if the mind isn't willing, the leg won't work. With you, I know I don't have to worry about that.
He grins at me.
You're going to do and be whatever you want.
I thank him again and wave a cheery goodbye to Chloe. Then I walk out of there. This time with a spring in my step. Chapter 18. When Fiona picks me up for our movie shift that night, I'm excited to show her my new moves.
Wow,
she says after I've done my best runway impression along our hallway.
You are smooth.
I laugh and do a little dance.
It's awesome.
So you ready? She asks. Do you need to say bye to your mom or anything? I shake my head. She's out doing something with Kaylee, and Dad's still at work.
Well, then, let's roll.
The Tremont Theater has a little kiosk in front where tickets are sold. It is attached to the foyer, but it sticks way out, and tonight Greta is behind the window.
She looks like a gypsy fortune teller,
I whisper to Fiona as we approach.
She sure does,
Fiona says with a giggle. But something about it is odd. Greta never actually takes a position. She more moves around the place supervising. I wonder what happened. She never works the window. Fiona whispers,
She should, though, don't you think? Look at her. It would be great for business. People would come up wondering about having their fortune told, and she could sell them on the movie instead.
Hi, girls, Greta says through the window. Everything okay? I asked.
Sure it is. Just incredibly slow is all.
She waves a gnarled hand toward the entrance.
Go on. I'm sure you can find something to clean, anyway.
Fiona holds the door open for me, and when I step inside, I'm struck by how quiet it is. And empty. It's weird. There's no one behind the counter, no one ordering food, no one at all anywhere. Feels like I've stepped onto an empty movie set. Or into a wax museum. Or,
surprise!
Heads pop up from behind everywhere, and at first I'm just shocked. But as I start to absorb who's there, I realize it's the track team. And Cairo, and my parents, and my sister, and Gavin, and Hank, and Chloe, and Marla Sumner, along with her cameraman.
Well, girl, Greta says from beside me, I'd say the celebration has begun.
I turn to her, but what about... She snorts.
Honey, the place is all yours.
Cairo's heading toward me, followed by the rest of the crowd. He's carrying an enormous rectangular box wrapped in gold foil paper and a broad blue ribbon. My mom's crying. My dad is, too. My teammates are pogoing around like maniacs, so excited to be giving me this gift. Hank grins at me, and through my tears I tell him,
"You stinker!"
Cairo hands the box over, and he's teared up, too.
Run well, Jessica.
I carry the box over to the popcorn counter, and while everyone gathers around, I unwrap my running leg. I already know what it's going to look like. Hank and I have gone over it many times. It's going to be a black, J-shaped leg with a smooth foot instead of spikes. The spikes will get added later when I'm ready to race. It'll also have an awesome flame fabric that Fiona and I picked out embedded in the socket. So I know what it's going to look like, but that's not what I see when I open the box. The J-shaped part is there, but there's nothing flame-like about the socket. It's blue, with some strange yellowish-gold pattern. My first reaction is, this is the wrong leg. But then I see that the strange yellow pattern is writing. Signatures. Comments. Things my teammates have written. Run, Jessica. We love you, Jessica. Run like the wind. You're amazing. Believe. Race me. Welcome back, Jessica. It's a bird. It's a plane. No, it's Jessica Carlisle. I can't read anymore because I'm sobbing. Fiona hands me a napkin, and I wipe my eyes and choke out. I love you guys. What did I ever do to deserve you? Thank you so, so much. I lay the leg back inside the box and hug everybody. Everybody. And while I'm hugging, I notice something that makes me feel even better. My dad and Cairo are shaking hands, smiling. A few minutes later, Hank and Cairo make a date to meet me at the track the next day so we can figure out and fine-tune the leg. And then Greta turns on some music, and we party. We eat too much popcorn, we drink too much soda, and we dance. On two joyous feet, I dance. Part 5. Starting line. Chapter 1. My first day with a running leg, I definitely do not go out and charge over Agory Bridge. I can barely even walk in the thing. It's a strange contraption. Stilty and almost scary. It's also taller than my good leg, which Hank says it's supposed to be, but I feel off kilter. Completely unbalanced. Cairo and Hank work with me on the Liberty track, but I'm afraid of the leg. It makes me feel like I'm going to fall or trip or crash and burn. Plus, Mom and Kaylee and Fiona and some of the track team are there, and I feel like people have really high expectations. Expectations that I'm not even coming close to meeting. Everyone tells me not to worry about it, but I do worry about it. People paid a lot of money to buy me this leg, and it frustrates me that I can't work it right. Hank makes adjustments for me, but no matter what he does to it, it just doesn't feel right. My legs are so different from each other, like strangers, that will never really work well together. It seems like they should either both be running legs or both be regular legs. One of each is a mismatch, one I can't get the rhythm for. It's not until 3 sessions later that things start going better. This isn't a walking leg, or even a jogging leg. It's a running leg. And when I finally really push for the first time, something inside me clicks and bursts free. It's like I'm a little kid again, wobbling along on my bicycle. I'm exhilarated, terrified, gaining speed, sure to crash. It's a wild, electrifying feeling, and once I get the taste of it, I'm hooked. I go out to the track every day. At first, I switch legs in the car, but it's cramped and cumbersome, and I finally get the guts to walk out to the infield on my flex foot leg, and then, in front of God and athletes and middle-aged joggers, switch to my running leg. I'm getting good at the switch. It only takes me about 10 seconds now. And I'm more comfortable with the leg, more comfortable with people's curiosity. That is amazing, people tell me as we share the track. I always agree. Yes, it is. I also discover something painful. I am out of shape. But as every athlete knows, no pain, no gain. So I push myself. Sometimes I run with Fiona, sometimes by myself, and sometimes I have sessions with Cairo. He has me visualize smooth running, which in some mysterious way seems to help. I haven't graduated from the track yet because even though I've been running every day for over 2 weeks now, Mom's not allowing me to run streets for a while. She's still worried about me tripping or slipping, and the track just seems safer to her. So I am getting used to it, and I am gaining confidence, but I honestly don't know if I'll ever race again. It almost doesn't matter, though. I can run. Chapter 2. I have the running dream again. It's early morning. Sherlock's whole body is wagging as he dances in a circle by the front door. We ease out, turn right when we hit the street, and head toward the river. The world is quiet. No cars, no people, no hustle and bustle, just the rhythmic sound of our feet against the pavement. Sherlock is happy beside me. Aroo! He says, for no apparent reason. Oh! We reach the river, and the air is heavenly, cool and moist. It sparkles my face, washes my lungs, cools the building heat of my body. I soar beneath the trees, transform into wind. We come upon Agory Bridge, and I begin the long sprint across it. My legs and lungs burn, but I welcome this pain. It forges me with strength, determination, triumph. I drop back the pace now and glide along the streets, back past familiar houses, back home. The sun is brighter now, the air warmer. Sweat pours from me, cool, salty, cleansing sweat. On the porch again, Sherlock kisses me and pants as I tousle his ears. Good boy, I tell him. You are such a good boy. Our sleepy neighborhood is stirring, waking up. And this time I stay on the porch with Sherlock and enjoy it. This time there is no shock for me, no jolt awake, no tears. This time, the running dream is real. Chapter 3. Now that Mom's cut me loose and I'm in good enough shape, Sherlock and I run the whole 5-mile loop over Agory Bridge every morning. When I wake up tired, I remind myself how long I've waited to be able to run again, and it gets me up, gets me moving into that plane between dreaming and reality where only running seems to take me. Some mornings I see Rosa on her porch, and when I do, I finish my run, then trot back to visit with her. It's a nice cool down for Sherlock, and for me. We talk about her online friends and the summer courses she's been taking online and the places she's seen online that she dreams about going to someday. I start to see that the internet is the way she travels, the way she socializes, the way she feels like part of things. It's the place where people see her, not her condition. Often on my walk home, I try to think of ways to help her live some of the things she dreams about. But I have no idea what to do. I feel bad, too, that she wasn't at my surprise party and that she wasn't asked to sign my socket. If I had known about the party, I would have made sure she was there. But even Fiona, who was the kindest, most thoughtful person on earth, didn't think about inviting her. Rosa is invisible. She finds out about parties after they're over. This time from a TV newscast. She didn't pout or try to make me feel bad about the party. She was just congratulatory and happy for me. But I did feel bad. I still feel bad. She's the one who got me through Ms. Rucker's class. She helped me feel hope. She cheered me on and made me see things in ways I hadn't before. She should have been there. And now I'm running again. I know I'll never be able to run a 55 flat and a 400 again. Cairo timed me at the track the other day and I ran a 71.5, but that's okay. I'm happy just to be running. And I will work up to competing. Maybe in a longer race, like the 1600. Cairo says he'll help me find the race that's right for me, and I'm looking forward to that. Rosa, though, is still the same. And I can see momentum pulling me out of her life. We have different interests. We're in different years in school. It wouldn't be hard for her to fade into my past. But I don't want that to happen. I don't want Rosa to be left behind.
Chapter 4. I get the idea right before I fall asleep. And then I can't sleep. I'm up half the night thinking about it, adding to it, visualizing it, wondering if it's even possible. In all the thinking I do, I never for a minute think it's crazy, but I'm afraid my parents will. So early the next morning, I put on my running legs, sneak downstairs, and find my wheelchair in the garage. "Come on, boy," I whisper to Sherlock, and make a sly exit out the side door of the garage. The wheelchair is small, light, easy to push. I make it to the end of the block and back, no problem. So I put a big sack of potting soil in the seat and try again. It's already harder. Much harder. "Okay," I tell myself, "see what you can do." "Let's go," I tell Sherlock, and he falls into step beside me as I push the wheelchair along the streets of our usual route toward Agri Bridge. It's late August. So although it's only 6 o'clock, the sun is already up and the air is warming. Even before the 1 mile mark, I'm sweating and panting hard. My arms are straining. My legs can feel the burn. Any uphill, no matter how slight, feels 10 times harder than it usually does. And it's becoming clear that I am not going to be able to do this for the full 5 miles of my loop. "A little farther," I tell myself. "Then you can turn around." I coax myself forward with milestones. Just to the end of the block. Just to the stop sign. Just to the next bend. My arms are tired of holding the handles. I want to let go. I want to stop. But I press on. Just to the next intersection. Just to the moving van. Just to the top of the rise. I feel a hot spot forming on my stump. A warning sign Hank has told me I should pay close attention to. Blisters, he says, can set me back weeks. "Jessica!" I'm hearing my name, but I'm not. "Jessica! Hey!" I slow, then stop and turn to face the sound. A man is waving at me from across the street. He's tan, lean, handsome. He's wearing running shorts, a sweat-drenched t-shirt. And as he crosses over, I'm thinking, it can't be him. But then, there it is, chin scruff. "Gavin?" I'm suddenly aware how odd it is to be running with a load of potting soil in a wheelchair. He laughs. "What are you doing?"
I follow his gaze to the wheelchair. Hard to explain. He doesn't press.
Okay, well, you want some company? I could run with you.
Actually, I was getting ready to turn around. I usually do a loop, but I'm not gonna make 5 miles pushing this thing. I'm already wiped out.
So I'll run back with you.
I turn the wheelchair around.
Don't feel like you have to watch over the crazy girl pushing a load of potting soil. I'll be fine.
And then, out of the blue, he asks, Do I bug you, or what? My head snaps to face him. What are you talking about?
You always seem like you're trying to get away from me.
I do?
Yeah. I think that we're having a good time, and then you'll practically ditch me.
Wow! I'm sorry. I didn't mean it like that.
Then what?
I start jogging, and he stays right beside me. A heavy silence between us. Finally, I say, Look, you've been really nice and really helpful, but I don't want you to do things for me or pay attention to me because you feel sorry for me. He's quiet a minute.
Is that what you think?
Kinda, yeah. And I want to add, I also think you've got a secret crush on Fiona, but I'm already feeling bad for what I did say.
Look,
I finally say, I'm sorry,
I made that mistake once, okay? I sure wouldn't do it again.
I glance at him. What are you talking about?
Does the name Meryl ring a bell?
We run along in silence for a bit. Are you saying...
We broke up.
He shakes his head.
It was just a mistake. She was a mess at Lucy's funeral, and I got caught up in feeling sorry for her, but it was a terrible reason to go out with her.
Sorry to hear that, I say softly, because really I don't know what else to say.
And of course I felt sorry for you, but...
He stops running.
Didn't you read what I wrote on your running leg? Does it say, I feel sorry for you? No, it says, you inspire me. I want to be around you because you inspire me. You're amazing. I think you're the most...
I stop running and look at him. His hair is pressed off his forehead and sticking out at the sides. His t-shirt is still soaked and he's covered in sweat. He is gorgeous.
Incredible person. And I did read what he wrote on my running leg. I read it over and over and over. I have ever known.
He's looking at me too, but... He doesn't seem to be looking at my hair, which is surely a mess, or thinking about the sweat I'm covered in. He's just looking into my eyes.
So what are you saying?
I ask meekly. He looks at me a few moments longer, then answers with a long, salty kiss. Chapter 5. Sherlock barks, howls, and spins in a circle. I pull away and laugh, then tell Gavin. He's saying you kissed a one-legged girl who's pushing around a wheelchair with potting soil in it. He looks at Sherlock.
And she kissed me back.
He turns to me and he's smiling, really smiling.
So does this mean you don't think I'm annoying?
I shake my head, and as we start walking toward my house, I let him push the wheelchair and tell him, I've actually been trying hard not to like you. Besides, I was sure you had a thing for Fiona.
For Fiona?
He lets that sink in.
No wonder you were always ditching me.
So we talk and catch up and confess all sorts of silly things. And when we're on my street, he says,
So is this wheelchair thing to build up your strength? Running with this would not be easy.
No. Well, yeah, I guess so. I shake my head a little. I just had this idea, but now I don't think it'll work.
So what's the idea?
And in that moment, I decide to tell him. You know Rosa, right?
Of course.
Well, she lives around the corner from me on Marigold.
Okay.
It's a long story, but